antifaz que tu maldad cubría.
Good afternoon, this is Erin Fitzpatrick at the Root of It at Heritage Radio Network, HRN, recording out in Bushwick at Roberta's restaurant. We're here today with Grant Phelps. This is segment two, two-part series. While Grant is here in town, we're fortunate enough to have an opportunity to speak with him. Grant Phelps is the chief winemaker at Viuminet. And we wrapped up last week's segment with discussion about Chile as an ideal wine-producing country and how, as a winemaker, it's a pleasure to be able to work with these old vines at the vineyard at Viuminet. And wanted to continue discussion this afternoon about, more specifically, the wines that you're producing, how they have been perceived with respect to aging. I know you do quite a tier. You're almost 23, 25 bottlings now.
Something like that. Let me start off by saying thanks, Erin, to you for giving me an excuse to spend a whole week in New York. It truly is the greatest city in the world. It's a nice change from where I live. You've been to my house. You know,
yeah.
I live in the middle of a vineyard.
Beautiful. I actually wasn't ready to leave. As much as I go away and travel, there's places that I go to when I'm like, okay, I'm done, ready to come cruising back down to the island. There's nothing better than feeling like coming back to New York. But I was getting pulled away hard from that vineyard, I have to say.
I have the opposite experience. I spend almost all of my time living in a vineyard. My nearest neighbors are a couple of miles away, as you know. So it's nice to come to a big city every now and then. For me, this is relaxing. This is like for you going to the country.
Right, right.
Thank God I'm leaving tomorrow, though, because I don't think my liver can take any more of it. 7 days in the big city with all this great wine is it's not a good situation to be in.
Just grab some milk thistle. That's the new liver treatment.
Is that right? I was actually looking at a transgenic implant or transplant, something like that.
Don't go that far. We need you around. No, but the property is so beautiful. It's an old family vineyard. There's equestrian fields, polo fields. You can take your horses around at dusk, and there's fig trees, and you're on the horse, and you're grabbing fig trees. It's a piece of paradise in my mind. So
I wouldn't know, Erin. I'm always in the winery,
you're
slaving
always,
away.
You know,
they don't let me out of the cellar to enjoy the nicer aspects of living in the Colchagua Valley.
I'm a bit of a hedonist, so I did take the opportunity to indulge in some of those experiences.
Yeah. Erin spent much less time making wine than she did riding horses and drinking. But never mind.
Never mind
we
that.
We enjoyed having her around.
Thanks. So, Malbec. You're producing Malbec at the vineyard, and this is probably one of the only wineries in Chile that I've seen really with such standout Malbec. Is that the case?
Well, Malbec is a bit of an interesting thing in Chile. Basically, Malbec has a long history in South America. It's called Malbec in South America, the reason being that it was introduced originally to Argentina by a guy with the last name of Malbec,
mm-hmm.
which is why it took that name in South America.
Instead of Cot, which it's called in Bordeaux.
Cot or Serrois, those are the original names. There's a lot of debate about where it originally came from and what the first name was, but it's got two names in France. It is originally a French variety, but it was introduced to South America. No one knows exactly when, but it was by a guy with the last name of Malbec. Ending in a K, not in a C, actually. Mm-hmm. The first record of it in Chile was a grapevine survey carried out by commissioned by the French government in 1712. They sent down a French very young French ampelographer. He identified 12 different grapevines being grown in Chile at that time. One of them was Malbec, so we know it has at least 300 years of history in Chile. Basically, what happened was in Chile, there was a lot of Malbec planted. It's a grapevine which has grown really well historically in Chile.
Mm-hmm.
However, Chile is a country which is kind of confused about its wine drinking, if you like. In the year 1900, Chileans drank per capita 105 liters. What's that, about 35 gallons or 33 gallons per capita? That shrunk last year to 14, or the year before last, to 14 liters. Which is the last time I saw the numbers, which officially made us the lowest, well, the country wine producing country in the world with the lowest per capita consumption.
What's going on there?
Below the US. The US has always been the record holder because in the US, 50 states
Sure. I don't know. It's much bigger.
Well, 10 drink seriously wine, the other 40 drink seriously beer and other things. Exactly.
White spirits.
Which is why the US has always been kind of low. But no, Chile, we successfully beat you guys last year or the year before last. And so wine consumption's shrinking there. And there's never really been a lot of concept of fine wine in Chile.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of fine wine has come exclusively from exports. Chile currently exports about 70% of its production, which makes it officially the highest exporting country in the world. Not in terms of volume, but in terms of percentage of production. We export more of our production than any other country in the world. The reason being, the Chileans, aren't drinking it.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to sell it somewhere, right? But all the growth in the Chilean wine industry, and there's been, we've pretty much doubled in terms of plantings in Chile in the last 10 years. All of that's come from exports. And basically, at the start of the 1990s, when Chile started to export wine, which, you know, it's a very recent history, really.
Yeah.
We're only less than 20 years since Chile's been exporting its wine in a serious manner. In that time, at that time, back in the early 90s, no one had heard of Malbec in England, which is where we started to export our wine.
Mm-hmm. That was the first market.
That was the first market which was exploited. And no one had heard of it, therefore we couldn't sell it. Therefore, almost all of the old vine Malbec got ripped out and replanted with Cab Sav and Merlot, which is what the English were asking for at the time, the English supermarkets.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very sad. The great thing about Viuminen is we've got some really old vine Malbec. It's a family-owned winery. The owner at the time, Miguel Viu, who's still the owner, or his son is the owner now, or is the grandson of the founder, in fact, he loved Malbec. He had a passion for Malbec. He knew it was the best thing he had planted. Our oldest vines, even though the company's only about 78 years old,
mm-hmm.
our oldest vines are 120 years old. These are vineyards we bought in the mid-1950s.
Wow. Yeah.
So he knew that the Malbec was really special and refused to bow to market pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And so today we're recognized as the Malbec pioneers in Chile. We were the first winery in Chile to release a straight Malbec back in 1994. 100%
varietal, yeah.
And labeled as such. And today we've grown to the point where of our 27 wines, 9 of them are Malbecs. So we do a lot of Malbec.
Yeah.
You've seen a fair bit of it, Aaron. I mean, we do rosé, we do a port, we do...
True. I haven't had the port. That was on reserve.
Well, no one's had the port. It's still not released, but
okay.
It's in barrel, 2006 yeah. vintage. But we do the rosé. We've just released a new Argentinian project, which is tiny production. It's only a few hundred cases, but basically what gave me the excuse to go over to Argentina frequently and eat lots of beef and drink too much Argentinian wine.
Challenge your biggest competitors.
Well, I don't think Argentina is our biggest competitors. I think Argentina's done us a huge favor by making South America a kind of a wine destination, if you like.
Fair enough. Your neighbor, if your neighbors are doing good things, it only is a better reflection on...
Well, to be honest, we're not direct competitors as countries because Argentina does great Malbec, and I don't really think... I think they struggle to do other varieties
things, right.
as well as we do in Chile, to be honest, and trying to be reasonably impartial because I'm not a Chilean. I do make wine in Argentina as well, but I think Argentina does great Malbec,
mm-hmm.
without a doubt. They do a couple of other things really well, Bonarda, maybe, Torrontés.
But yeah.
I think everything else... To my mind, we do better in Chile. I think mm-hmm. the Sauvignon Blanc, the Chardonnay. Chile has a much wider range of climates.
Of course, yeah. It's very dry in Mendoza. And
it's very hot in Mendoza.
And dry, yeah.
Mendoza is a place where the heat is extreme compared to Chile.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the Argentinians do a great job of marketing their country because of the altitude and everything else, but it's very hot. It's much hotter than Chile.
Yeah.
And for that reason, I think a lot of varieties struggle to ripen. Malbec is so predominant in Argentina because it handles the heat really, really well,
mm-hmm.
much better than, say, Cabernet Sauvignon or Syrah, and certainly much better than the whites.
But you can brag a little bit here. I mean, you have been in competitions with 12 other outstanding Argentinian Malbec producers and tasting blind in front of a panel of judges, and Viuminen's Malbec has won before. Is this correct?
Yeah, there's a competition. It's really small. It's an industry-only competition. It has a lot of kudos within the industry, but they're not
uh-huh.
results which get released because it's not a kind of a made public,
trade,
if you
yeah.
like.
Yeah.
It's a competition called Vinos de la Cordillera, or Wines of the Andes, and it's the 12 highest-ranked sort of Chilean wines head-to-head against the 12 highest-ranked Argentinian wines. It's been running for 3 years. The first year was in Mendoza. It was 58 Argentinian winemakers and a couple of us from Chile. I count myself as one of the Chilean representatives.
Okay.
And in that competition, the View won, which is our top Malbec, won the competition as the best wine of the tasting. The next year it was held in Santa Cruz in the Colchagua Valley, and with this time with 30 Chilean winemakers and 30 Argentinians judging, once again we won. Last year I think we came in fifth place, so we've been pretty consistent at least.
Yeah, for sure. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of what spawned then the interest in this Argentinian project? Tell us a little bit about that and the name of it.
To be honest, well, Argentina started off because I just was really curious about what was happening on the other side of the Andes.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to get over there and just get in amongst it. And to be honest, the whole idea of making a wine over there started off with as me trying to come up with an excuse to get over there on company time regularly and just really see what was happening. And that's how it started. It's called Vibo because the current name of the family is Vibotini.
Vibotini, okay.
And it's a Malbec. It's from the Uco Valley, which is the coolest part of Mendoza, highest mm-hmm. altitude. And it's a few hundred cases. We just launched it 2 weeks ago in Mendoza. And
excellent.
It should be available here in New York shortly.
Great. And that's also something that Jose Miguel, who is the family proponent now of Yemenet, was interested in it as well.
Jose Miguel's a really cool guy to work with because, I mean, for me it's really important to work with family-owned wineries because they're the guys who really care about the quality of the wine because their name's on the label.
Right.
And Jose Miguel, especially as an owner, as a boss, is just a cool guy because he's young, he's innovative, and if mm-hmm. you talk to him about stuff, if you can show him you're enthusiastic, he'll get behind it.
Get behind it, yeah. That's great.
And that's what happened with Vibo.
Mm-hmm. So it's small production, and you see that most of the wine there is going to be an export, or...?
Invariably. I mean, Chileans don't drink that much wine and they drink even less Argentinian wine because
right.
Chileans hate Argentinians. It's sort of like I struggled to understand it when I first moved to Chile, but now I just pretend that Argentinians are Australians and they annoy the crap out of me as well. But speaking seriously, it's the small neighbor, big neighbor syndrome.
Yeah,
you know?
I get it.
Well, I travel over the world. I'm a Kiwi and everyone always goes, "Hey, you're an Aussie." Canadians get pissed off with you guys for the same reason.
Exactly.
And Chileans get annoyed with the Argentinians. It's the way it goes.
And is there only one? Is it one wine with two tiers, or is it just?
It's going to be two tiers. Currently, uh-huh. it's just one.
Okay.
Which is the 07 vintage, which has just been released. But with the 08 vintage, there's going to be two.
Great.
There's the Vibo and the Vibo Plus. I don't know what it's called. That's a tentative name.
Hyper Vibo.
Ultra Vibo, Hyper Vibo,
Uber
Vibo Turbo. Who knows? But it'll be something along those lines.
So in New York, that selection will be distributed and imported and distributed by Andrew Bell Wine Symphony, who distributes the rest of the Viamonette portfolio.
Well, we certainly hope so.
Yeah. Great.
That'd be nice. It's up to Andrew, I guess.
Well, you just did some new wines as well. You did a Pinot Noir from the 08 vintage, which is a brand new thing too, right?
The Pinot Noir is released under the Secreto name, which is our label, which is Secreto was my pet project when I came on board as winemaker 7 years ago, wanting to do some small volume, more innovative, more new world, more funky, if you like, wines. That's a new wine for us in the Secreto range from last year from Casablanca. Bottled with a screw cap, which is our first red wine bottled with a screw cap, actually.
Really? I tried it last week at the Grand Wines of Chile tasting. I thought it was great.
Cool. Thank you very much.
It had some nice grip to it for a little Pinot.
Yeah, you know, I started off as a Pinot specialist, and so Pinot is very close to my heart. And I do love Pinot. I think Chile's doing a really great job on Pinot. There's been Pinot mania there for the past 3 or 4 years, ever since Alexander Payne's Sideways movie came out.
Right.
It started the whole craze. And Chile, I think, is one of the few countries in the world which is doing cheap, if you like, Pinot well. I mean, we're talking $12 to $15 Pinot. It's for the price, drinkable and good and tastes like Pinot. Having said that, I didn't want to get into that whole thing of cheap Pinot. I want to do something really interesting, something with distinct personality. It's not necessarily really Pinot-like. It's not a sort of a Burgundian style of Pinot. It's a very new world. It's very dark fruit, a lot of spice.
Right.
A bit of tar and leather. It's a style of Pinot, which, like you said, it's got grip, it's got structure. It's a mm-hmm. wine which will benefit from 3, 4, maybe even 5 years of cellaring.
With the screw cap, even?
Definitely with a screw cap.
Great.
Wines age much better with a screw cap than with a cork.
Really? Okay,
oh,
we're
yes.
going to continue that conversation and take a quick break. This is Grant Phelps from Viamonette. And I'll see you in a bit. Returning here today, this is Aaron Fitzpatrick at the Root of It at HRN, Heritage Radio Network, recording out at Roberta's in Bushwick. I'm here today, this Tuesday, June 23rd, with maybe Chilean's most eligible bachelor, Grant Phelps from Viuminet, chief winemaker.
Nice, I like that. It's the first time I've been called that. I've been called a lot of things.
Throwing you a bone there, yeah.
Nice.
So, get some New Yorkers to continue the pilgrimage down to Chile to explore the gorgeous countryside.
Wouldn't that be great?
Mm-hmm. And he's a pretty damn good DJ as well.
There you go.
But anyway, we just ended that last segment with discussion about screw caps and corks. And I found your comment regarding aging potential of wine in screw cap, that it's better than cork, quite interesting, if not controversial.
There you go. I like to be a bit contentious, apparently. No, I wasn't trying to be contentious, although I really got it from you. I got it in the neck from Aaron during the break there. No one out there heard that, but we almost came to blows. It was ugly. It was sort of reality TV kind of stuff. Thank God there's no camera in the studio. No, basically, yeah, screw caps. I mean, I'm from New Zealand. New Zealand is the most screw-capped country in the world, the most screwed country in the world. There you go. Currently in New Zealand, 96% of all wines, well, the last time I saw the stats, it was 96% of everything was under screw cap, including red wine, and we make a lot of Pinot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a young winemaker, I'm open to new ideas and everything else, but I was sort of anti-screw caps to start off with as well. But what happened was during the 90s, there was an experience in New Zealand where the cork barons, some of the richest guys in the world, and they own banks, they own a lot of stuff, and they're not really nice guys.
And they control the cork world.
They control the cork world, and no one really likes dealing with them, and they've got a monopoly, and they know they have, and they treat everyone like shit, basically. And we had the experience in New Zealand where one of the big cork suppliers sent New Zealand knowingly a tainted batch of corks, and that ruined a lot of wine. That was back in probably the late 90s. I forget the actual year. I remember the wines. I remember what happened. I remember the whole controversy of the whole thing. And the guy who was involved told me the story. I mean, he's a good friend of mine. He said, Grant, I asked the guy to come over urgently and discuss this with me. And he came and he sat down at a restaurant with me in Auckland. And he said to me, okay, so I sold you some dud corks. What are you going to do about it?
Ooh.
And my friend basically stood up, grabbed his plate of food, threw it on this guy, on his expensive Armani suit or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and said, you guys, I'm not going to buy any more corks from you guys or from anyone else from Portugal. And that was the guy who started developing screw caps, or he developed his own brand of screw caps.
Uh-huh.
Screw caps had already been around for a while. But he developed his own brand, and he really got behind it. He was the biggest cork supplier in Chile in New Zealand at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he got behind screw caps, and he basically bottled a lot of wines under screw cap and under cork, and just did comparative tastings. And he managed within about 3 or 4 years to convince virtually everyone in New Zealand that corks were superior to, sorry, that screw caps were superior to corks, including with older vintage wines. And I participated in the same tastings, and it blew me away.
Really?
Tasting the wines blind, every single wine. Out of 20 wines, I preferred the screw-capped wine, whites and reds. So
it's funny you say that, because there was our guest last week, Tom Gannon for Rothman Steakhouse here in New York, said
I know Tommy's going to shoot me for contradicting him.
Well, no, I think it's interesting. You know, we'll have him back here, and we'll discuss this more in the future. But he did a tasting, participated in one, where they had a cork and a screw top next side by side, blind, and wines that they're tasting in glass, obviously. And everyone in the room raised their hand for the wine that was bottled with cork as opposed to screw cap. And so we got into this bit of discussion about the fact that I think screw caps have their place. And for young wines that are meant to be drunk young, they make complete sense. They're less cost. You know, they're easy. To your point, they might make a wine taste exactly how it should be, and where cork kind of changes it in bottle a little bit.
Well, cork, in my opinion, changes wines in negative ways. I mean, basically, if a wine with a cork's really different from a screw cap, it's probably because it's corked. I mean, it's probably got TCA, it's got bacterial or whatever, or other issues, microbiological issues. My take on it is the opposite from Tom's take on it. You know, I'm looking at it from the other side of the industry. I'm a producer rather than a seller or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of respect to Tom. He does a great job. He knows what he's talking about. But my experience in these tastings, and I've done it multiple times, not just that one time. I mean, I just my experience is that screw caps are superior. And getting really into the literature, if you look at the scientific literature really seriously, virtually all the evidence shows that wine changes, the changes in the bottle are anaerobic, they're not aerobic, or they're reductive, they're not oxidative. So it's not, the corks only let air into the bottle or oxygen to the bottle if they're actually leaking, in which case it'll oxidize.
So they're not porous per se.
They shouldn't
like you
be.
Might think they are.
No, a good cork should not be porous.
Right.
It shouldn't let air into the bottle. So the changes in the bottle are reductive.
Right.
And so between a screw cap and a cork, if it's a good cork and a screw cap, should be no difference whatsoever. What you have to think about is that with about 8% of corks, there's a cork taint issue. And cork taint issues are really tricky from the point of view of a producer, because I taste my wines really regularly. You know, we have, you know, journalists coming to the winery, importers, clients of the winery. They come and I sit down with them to taste all the wines. I do it probably once a week all year round, the whole range of wines, all 27 wines that we make. And sometimes there are wines that I go, nah, that wine's just not right. It just doesn't have the fruit it should have. There's something slightly wrong. I'll uncork another one. It looks way better. You know, there's an obvious cork taint, which probably everyone knows. That's that moldy, horrible, wet,
musty,
kind of nasty smell. That obviously still happens, but that's a relatively small percentage of cork taints. There's a lot of cork taints that just make the wine look astringent and hard and rob it of its fruit. And unless you know the wine intimately, you're not going to spot it. You know, as a wine producer, as a winemaker, that's hugely problematic, because people might buy one of my wines and they taste it. It's got no fruits, kind of flat. And they're like, that wine just sucked. I'm not buying any more of Jumanin. If they know it's corked, they're going to blame the cork. But if they don't know it's corked, they just blame the wine.
Sure.
And therefore the winery, and therefore
it
hurts us, you know. And I think screw caps are great in that perspective, because they're not cheaper, actually. I mean, a cheap cork is cheaper than a cheap screw cap.
Really?
We just spent a lot of money installing the machinery to do it. It's an expensive piece of technology. It's really not a cheap option. There's a certain bad kind of image that goes along with screw caps, and sommeliers like Tom Gannon hate them, because there's nothing worse than having to
present a bottle at a table
with a screw cap, because it doesn't go plop. You don't get the whole ceremony of the corkscrew and everything else. I understand it. I mean, it's really awkward for sommeliers. But, you know, especially in Tom's case, he's not good at making that whole kind of noise with his, you know, people don't
on the other hand, you've been practicing that for years.
Well, people don't like seeing the sommelier stick his finger in his mouth and doing the whole thing. So it's not very hygienic, right? So I can understand, generally sommeliers are really anti-screw caps, but if you talk to winemakers, they're really pro. Most wine importers are really pro. I think most consumers would be really pro if they understood the difference.
Yeah, I think that's going to be, that would take a little while to get that.
This is where I get
shot. All right,
this
that's is where I get the winery shot. Calling.
Yeah, exactly. So that was chilly. I cut them off.
I think it would take a little while for the general public, the general consumer, to get on board with that whole idea. But when you think about the future and the investment that you just made in the winery, do you think that you will eventually change all of the bottlings to be screw cap?
I think so. I think with the Icon wines, there's always going to be resistance mm-hmm. with that really high price point.
So the highest end wine you're doing is the View 1, if you think that you were to be able to change that to screw cap, I think it would take a little bit of time for people to get used to that idea.
I think for me, the View 1 is, you know, I think screw cap would probably be better for the wine. I think there's when you get to that high, you know, $50, $60, $70 bottles of wine,
yeah,
there's a lot more resistance. I think even people are really pro screw cap when they get to $70, go, ooh, I'm going to lay this wine down for 5 or 6 years. I'd still rather it had a cork, even though it might. Mm-hmm. There's an 8% chance the wine will be ruined by the cork. I mean, look at California. Look what's happening there in New Zealand as well. A lot of the top, most expensive $100 bottles of wine or more with screw caps now. Screaming Eagle in Napa went to screw cap, 5 years ago? Mm-hmm. It was, I think, the first That's Icon true. Wine in
yeah.
California.
Yeah. You see it more, I think, in New Zealand and Australia, but yeah. That
true, may, true, very true.
California might just be right on board, and if that's the case, it would be a lot easier, I think, to move in that direction if there is good reason to do so, which you seem to think there is. So,
I think technically, yes. I think with the super Icon wines, it's kind of still, it's going to be tricky mm-hmm. for a few years to come.
Mm-hmm. And then leading into that conversation with respect to aging, we generally, I'd say I'll speak from a New Yorker's point of view or an American consumer, don't think about buying an expensive bottle of Chilean wine, or for that matter, even Argentinian wine too often, to say, oh, I'll drop $20, $30 on this and lay it down for a bit. It's more about pick up the bottle of wine, go to a dinner party, drink it that night. Where do you see the potential for Chilean wines to age?
Well, I think the ageability of wines now is kind of a bit of a vexed question, because you look at the statistics. I mean, I can't remember the exact number in the US, but I think last year in the UK it was 94% of wine which was purchased was uncapped and drunk within 24 hours. That's the statistic in the UK. The US statistic is very similar. I think it's a little bit less. But basically, people don't age wine anymore. That's kind of one of those things that was in the 70s and the 80s. People had their cellars. Wine's an everyday beverage now. It's not a thing for the elite, for mm-hmm. the people who know about wine. It's for everyone to enjoy. And with that, winemakers had to adjust their style and start to make wines which are really drinkable. Having said that, I mean, as a winemaker, I work for a small family-owned winery, and the advantage of that is you get to kind of make the wines you want to make.
Right.
I love to cook, and I like to make wine which goes with my food or with food in general. So I don't try to make really show-offy wines while they're young. I like to make wines with ageability, mm-hmm. Especially at the sort of $15 price point and above. I mean, I like the wines to improve with 2 or 3 years of aging. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a little bit irrelevant maybe, but it's still, for me, it's an important part of what wine should be. It should evolve and it should improve with a little bit of aging. Mm-hmm. I think it's sad if we get to the point where all wine has to be consumed within 6 months of bottling, or it kind of goes off and becomes flat and sad. You know, that's not the ideal situation. Having said that, though, I mean, Chile, I think, is a great country for making wines with ageability, much more so than Argentina. What you get is, in Argentina, you have
the riper fruit, as much structure necessarily.
Well, exactly. And the wines, in terms of climatically, it's very hot. Yeah. Okay. And Malbec, the focus is on Malbec because it enjoys the heat, it thrives in the heat. But the heat means that, especially at night, because it's so hot, the grapes burn through their acidity. Mm-hmm. The grapes are respiring at night. That's the major process. And during the day, it's photosynthesis. At night, they're respiring. During respiration, they're burning the acidity. They're breaking down the acidity in the grapes to produce energy to keep the plant growing. Mm-hmm. So what that means is, when you get around to picking the grapes, they've got less acidity. The other thing is, in Argentina, you have a really high salt content in the soils. It's very similar to Australia. Really high potassium levels. So what happens is, a lot of the acidity that's naturally present in the juice or in the fermenting juice drops out during the fermentation. It precipitates out with the potassium. So you have to add a lot of acid to the wine. Mm-hmm. So even still, the wines have high pH generally.
Right.
Low acidity. And
high alcohol.
High alcohol. And the wines are great when they're young. They're kind of that style that America loves, which is ripe and soft.
Sweet
and
fruit.
Round tannins and mm-hmm. really easy to drink. Chile, on the other hand, we get much better natural acidity because it's much cooler at night. We have the Pacific Ocean right next door, and the snow-capped mountains, Andes, are not far away. That wind that moves between those two things basically cools everything off at night. I mean, you know what it's like there. In Colchagua, even in the hottest months of the year, which is January and February, we're getting down to about 52 degrees at night.
It's ideal, yeah.
Even though we're getting up into the early 90s during the day sometimes.
Right, right.
There's a huge thermal difference between day and night, and that helps to maintain the acidity in the red wines.
Mm-hmm.
And so it means that our reds have great natural acidity and really good tannin structure as well, because there's loads of sunlight in Chile. And I think Chilean wines in general are really ageable. I mean, I know, and at least with Viuminen, I try to make wines by picking a little bit earlier maybe than some of our neighbors. I try to make wines with a bit more freshness, a bit more emphasis on black sort of fruit, and less staring away completely from those jammy kind of notes, which is a thing which a lot of consumers like, especially in the US, but which I really struggle with, because those jammy wines, well, some people love them and can't get enough of them. They're boring and they don't go well with food.
Well, that's what struck me about your vineyard and your wines as well. Actually garnered further interest because they were very imbalanced, and I could see that different range that you produce. So, not to float your boat, but I'll do it.
Keep floating my boat, Aaron. It's all good.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here. This has been a wealth of knowledge for our listeners and for me, and it's a pleasure to have you. So for all of our listeners, the website to check out some of the gorgeous property and wine at Viumanet is www.viumanet.cl. And wines are distributed by Andrew Bell Wine Symphony here in New York. So enjoy your rest of your stay. Good luck with the seminar tomorrow for all the American Sommelier students. And hope to see you back down in Chile very soon.
Righto, looking forward to coming back. Cheers, Aaron.
Cheers, and thanks again to our sponsor, VS Imports. See you next week. It all happened so fast that night.